Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
When the heavens went on sale. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Over the past 8 years, more than $260 billion in venture capital has been invested in the commercial space sector. Author and journalist Ashley Vance says this commercial boom was led by private companies like SpaceX, Planet Labs, and Rocket Lab, and shows no sign of slowing down. We'll speak with Vance about his new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. And we'll check in with John Schaffner, pilot for the upcoming private mission to the International Space Station, just days before his launch. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Here on 90.7 WMFE News. Journalist and author Ashley Vance wrote the 2015 New York Times bestselling biography of Elon Musk. He's back with a new book, taking a look at the changing landscape of commercial space. We'll hear from Vance about this new book and new chapter in commercial space, but first, let's check in with John Schaffner. He's the pilot of the upcoming AX2 mission, the second private mission to the ISS with Houston-based company Axiom. I spoke with Schaffner last week as he entered a mandatory 2-week quarantine ahead of his launch.
Well, we're outside of, in between Orlando and the Cape, sequestered in a nice little villa, the crew and, lots of people taking care of us, arrived a couple days ago, I guess. So nothing really relaxing about it. We're hard at work, actually.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the things that you have to do in these final moments. I know, last we talked, you were kind of wrapping up your training and just kind of waiting for the launch date, but now everything's kind of ramping up again, isn't it? What are some of the things that you're doing? And more importantly, what are some of the things you're thinking about? I mean, you're about to leave the planet.
Oh, man. There's a lot of stuff there. We do a number of things here. It's a chance for the crew to get together and work on final details as a crew. Previously, we've trained in groups or different segments with each other, but we're working on final refresher training, either ISS training, things that NASA wants us to know and understand to catch up on and review. SpaceX, Peggy and I are working on some approach and docking scenarios, just reviewing contingencies. And those are the operational parts. And a big, big part of this is starting to look at our actual on-orbit events and our timelines, our activities, the science, reviewing procedures that we have to execute to perform the science, reviewing the schedules for some of the events. I'm doing a lot of STEM activities, so confirming that the schools have correct audio-video connections, from the technical side. There's a lot going on just preparing for this, more than I would have imagined, sure.
Mm-hmm. And how about mentally, John? How are you getting in the headspace of getting ready to do this mission that you've thought about as we've talked since you were a kid?
Yeah, I have. Thank you. I've thought about this for a long, long time, since I was 8. So now imagining that it's 12 days away is very interesting. We came here after a couple of years of training and now looking down the pipe at just less than 2 weeks. So it seems like there's more to do than there is time left, but I'm sure we'll catch up to ourselves here. When you come in, it's the swirl of getting settled, getting used to new environments and staying confined. But yeah, today was better than yesterday. A little more clarity on our schedule and events, but it's an interesting process. I imagine all astronauts and crews go through this. So I'm at home in that knowledge. That I'm doing what everybody does in these cases.
That was John Schaffner, pilot of the upcoming AX2 mission. His mission is set to launch no earlier than Sunday. In the next decade, the number of satellites zooming over our head will reach 100,000. It's a sign of a growing commercial space sector that's garnered more than $280 billion in venture capital in only 8 years. So what's driving the investment, and who are the players? That's the subject of author and journalist Ashley Vance's new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Ashley Vance joins us now to talk about this changing sector in commercial space and his new book. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the new book is When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. This is coming a few years after a phenomenal book you wrote, Elon Musk, that profiled the founder of SpaceX. What was the motivation for this new book, Ashley?
It kind of came out of the last one in a lot of ways. I wrote this biography on Elon and had to cover all of his companies and his life. But the thing that really was my favorite to report on was SpaceX, and really the early days of SpaceX. It was quite an adventure of these 20-somethings trying to rethink the rocket industry. And right as I finished that book, I could see SpaceX had been this inciting incident around the world where a lot of people were thinking, gosh, maybe commercial space is real, and all these startups sprung up. There's people don't know this, but there's dozens of rocket companies around the world. There's hundreds of new satellite companies. And I started digging in and reporting. And then I found, again, another set of larger than life characters and stranger than fiction stories in this new world.
You know, this phrase is often overused in this industry, but space is hard, right? It's really difficult to build a rocket and get it to leave this planet. Do you have to be kind of a larger than life personality to take on a challenge of starting a rocket company? I mean, it sounds absolutely wild to think that someone can do that when it is so difficult.
Space absolutely remains hard, it is one of the more difficult things you can do, and I do think you need to be, at the moment, a pretty driven character. Although, an example of how much things have changed in my book, one of the main characters is this guy named Peter Beck, and he actually comes from New Zealand. He is a self-taught engineer. He was working at a dishwasher company as his first job. He never went to college, and he was doing rocketry as a hobby. He's an exceptional engineer, but he was making his own propellants, his own engines in a shed outside of his house in New Zealand. And he's turned his company, Rocket Lab, and it's taken a while, but they are now basically the second coming of SpaceX. They've launched dozens and dozens of rockets. And so it shows you, yes, Peter's like this exceptional figure, but something like that would not have at all been possible 20, 30 years ago. And so it's a new era where all kinds of things can be achieved around the world now.
Mm-hmm. What's driving that new era?
Well, money and ambition.
Of course.
The space industry really got stuck for decades. We had this amazing era with Apollo and all this excitement, and then we kind of locked in the rockets and the satellites, and nobody wanted to change things because they didn't want to mess up. And then I think SpaceX came along. It was such a shock to the system that it really did open up people's minds and their wallets. I mean, we've moved from government-backed stuff to billionaire-backed stuff, and now all the companies I write about are funded by investors, venture capitalists, and this is like not a nation state type thing anymore. And so, I think commercial space has had a bunch of false starts over the last couple decades, but then I think we got to this point where everyone decided we could really make a go of this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, was it SpaceX's public display of their development that kind of spurred this, that gave investors a sense that, hey, it's okay to put money in here, or for other companies like Peter Beck's Rocket Labs to come on and say, it's okay to fail? And I guess the long and short of the question I'm asking is, how much of this is because of SpaceX's development and what we know about how they developed their, you know, their Falcon 1 and the Falcon 9 and now Starship.
I think a lot of it because you had to have someone like Elon who, he had the double whammy, right? So other rich people had tried to make rockets and they'd gotten okay, decently far, but not seen it all the way through. Elon had his own money, then he had this success. And so this let people know, yes, this is possible. But then a huge chunk of this is just the modernization of technology. I mean, traditional aerospace really had been stuck. Nobody wanted to be the person that blew up a rocket because they changed some component on it trying to modernize it. And to your point, SpaceX and these other companies that have followed, obviously they're dealing mostly with satellites instead of humans, are willing to take more risks. And as a result, they've applied modern electronics, modern materials to these machines to help bring the cost down, make them better. And this now is the future.
Mm-hmm. Ashley, in the book, you spend quite a bit of time at another private company's facility, Astra. Can you just briefly tell us a bit about their story and what you learned about how that group is developing its rockets?
Yeah, Astra is based in Northern California. It was really exactly what I wanted to do, where I had a chance to be at this company from the moment it started, when it went from a garage to getting their first factory. And they are the most extreme end of where this stuff is heading. A typical space program that's run by a nation state, they're lucky if they launch their large rocket that costs $200 million once a month. And what Astra's trying to do is bring almost like the Henry Ford ethos to rocket building. So they're trying to make a rocket every day at their factory, to launch one every day and have this rocket cost just a few million dollars and be almost the FedEx of space. This is just a rocket where on a moment's notice, you want to put a satellite into orbit, you just go on a website, slap in a credit card, and you order it.
And that's wild to me.
It
right?
is, yeah. I mean, this is a new reality.
The on-demand rockets. But there's obviously a market for this, right? I mean, who is buying something like this? And do you get the sense that there is sustainability in this over the decades? I mean, or are we going to get to a point where there's just, you know, there's enough stuff up there, we don't need to keep sending anything else up there?
Yeah, I don't think most people are aware of this because they get fixated on space tourism or these missions to the moon or Mars. But as far as enough stuff, we have about, like in 2020, we had 2,500 satellites in orbit. We've already doubled it. And that was, you know, that's from 1960 to 2020. We put up 2,500. We've doubled that number over the last couple of years to 5,000. And this is not theoretical. We are very much on our way to putting up 100,000 satellites in the next 10 years. And this is not, maybe will this happen? This is definitely happening. SpaceX with their Starlink space internet system, they're putting up over 10,000 satellites. Amazon is about to put up over 10,000 satellites. China, another company called OneWeb. There's imaging satellites. They're going up by the hundreds. Is it sustainable? This is the multi-trillion dollar question. Everyone thinks there's big business to be had up there and they're going to make a go of this. We just don't know if all the business cases check out on this.
Mm-hmm. Ashley, you also talked or write in the book about another company, Firefly, as you mentioned, imaging satellites, like companies like Planet Labs. I haven't reported on many of these, but there is one company that's in our backyard, Relativity Space, and I've had the chance to check out their launch facility and stuff like that. And I'm wondering if you have noticed in these companies, you know, is there a through line? Is there something that connects all of them together? Is there some sort of trait that these companies all share that they're doing this almost impossible of launching things off of this planet? What makes them all similar?
Everyone seems to share, of course, kind of this love of space and interest in it. But it's interesting because each one has their unique tact, you know, and their special sort of thing that they're trying to do. You mentioned relativity. They've been most famous for trying to 3D print most of a rocket and stop it from being this kind of handmade special object that takes a long time to build. Planet Labs, the satellite company, it was founded by a group of like space hippies that wanted to monitor what was happening with the rainforest and movements of refugees and kind of the health of the Earth. I think we're turning a corner now. This is why I called the book When the Heavens Went on Sale, where it is becoming business. And so some of this, you know, idealism and love of space, yes, it's there, but there's also now just pure capitalist, pure industrialist that see an opportunity and want to find their niche in this world. Mm-hmm.
Space hippies. I love that description.
Wait till you read about them. They all live in a commune together in Silicon Valley. Although they're now multimillionaires.
It worked. Yeah. Whatever they did worked. And I mean, I think that we kind of take that stuff for granted now. I mean, I remember, you know, seeing images from space on, you know, the Soyuz canal blockage, you know, and that was from these satellites that were quickly deployed in orbit. Like we're so used to having these abilities, and that happened rather quickly, right? I mean, like on-demand satellite imaging is something that's really new.
Yeah, Planet Labs was founded, I think, in 2012 and really invented this field. They were the first ones to say, we don't have to make one large satellite that can only look at wherever it's being pointed. We can create hundreds of satellites, put them around the Earth. They're arranged in a pattern that's kind of like a line scanner. So the Earth is just rotating underneath these things and being photographed everywhere all the time. And it used to be the governments owned most of those imaging satellites. And of course, they took the images first and they doled out the ones they felt like sharing with the world. And they would often put their spin on the image. And now Planet is a service that you and I can log onto their website and see the stuff ourselves. Companies can buy, anyone can buy their images. And so there's this democratization going on. These handful of nations that used to control all of this stuff have very, very quickly ceded power to these commercial entities.
We're speaking with author and journalist Ashley Vance. Our conversation continues after the break. You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on 90.7 WMFE News. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with author and journalist Ashley Vance about his new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. The book is out now, and our conversation continues.
You mentioned that, I mean, hundreds of thousands of satellites are going to be placed in orbit. That's what's driving this industry. But there are some serious concerns about the overutilization of space or the sustainable usage of space. Are any of these concerns on the minds of these people that are developing the ability to get all of this stuff into space? You know, what do they see as kind of the environmental future of low Earth orbit?
Yeah, I mean, look, you can think of this as new territory to be conquered. We kind of know what humans tend to do when that opportunity arises, which is charge in as fast as you can and grab what you can. And that's kind of what's happening now. Everyone is pretty concerned because if you're one of these satellite companies rushing up there, the worst case scenario for you is still that some satellite hits another one and creates some debris field that makes all this impossible anyway. These are smart people trying to manage this. Can we do it really effectively as we go from 5,000 satellites to 100,000? The honest answer is nobody knows. There are now startups taking over these jobs that used to be done by federal agencies that aren't quite keeping up, where they have built their own antenna systems. One's called Leo Labs. They are tracking every object in space. They're helping these satellites coordinate their movements to dodge each other. But I think this is part of what I wanted to write about in the book, was to make people aware early on of what's happening, and just know that things are about to get quite chaotic.
And what should our concern be? I mean, like, if things are going to get chaotic up there, well, that's fine. I don't own any satellites. I have no assets up there. Why should we be concerned about this?
I mean, I think for the moment, this is fundamentally an optimistic story. I think we're going to have better communication systems than ever before. We're going to analyze and see our planet in ways we never could have before. But people should know there's things we already depend on that are up there. You know, if you think about GPS in particular, I mean, it's something we totally take for granted, but this is like this modern glue that makes our smartphones really work and all kinds of transportation systems. And these satellites are in the same area, right? If there's a debris field with these new ones, it's going to affect the infrastructure we have already put in place.
And it seems like this is an industry that is, you know, building. There's more and more money is being invested into it. Is there a concern that there is going to be an issue with recruiting people to do this kind of work? The rocket engineers, the highly skilled manufacturers that you need to put rocket parts together and satellites together. I mean, what is the future of, you know, the human capital look like for this industry?
Yeah, I think to some degree, although I think we have this image of space as being everything we've ever been fed in movies or books is it's our best and brightest, and you got to be an MIT engineer to work in this field. But that's definitely not the case now. I mean, I ran into so many people that were high school dropouts, college dropouts. They were welders from Texas or, you know, from the military, kind of 25-year-olds coming out and looking for work. And as this has become more like a business, yes, there's still rocket science to it, and there's usually a MIT PhD or two around, but much of this now is just like regular industry. And so, especially in the United States, we have so much talent that's been looking for a lot of stuff to do. And so, you know, there have been thousands of SpaceX employees, tens of thousands of people now. And so I largely see this as an opportunity, particularly for America, which, you know, our space program was heading in a very, very, very bad direction. And now is kind of the envy of the world when it comes to commercial space by a huge margin.
Mm-hmm. Ashley, part of the book's title is The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space in Reach. And, you know, I hear a lot, especially here in Florida, about commercial space. We have later this month, the second Axiom mission is launching with a private crew. And you talk to these people that are in the industry and say, you know, you're next, you know, soon we're going to be living and working in space thanks to, you know, these commercial companies. Is that really in our near future here? Is space within reach for, you know, the average American, let's say?
In terms of tourism, or like a space habitat, it's within reach, but I would say not in the short term. Even, you know, Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, they fired up their tourist flights where you get to go for about 6 minutes, and it was exciting there for a second, and then they both had trouble with both of their spacecraft and slowed down and are just about to start flying again. That was very much still the province of quite wealthy people, and it's like unclear at all how big that market is. We have a number of startups now that are making these space habitats, though, and once again, I mean, we are going to find out. We got the rockets to do this now. They're cheap enough for these startups to take a chance at these businesses, so we're absolutely going to find out. I think for the average person, just like any industry, this is going to take time for the cost to come down to some reasonable level.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Ashley, I want to ask you, and I know this isn't the topic of the book, but you have such an intimate knowledge with Elon and SpaceX. They had the recent orbital test flight attempt of Starship. It didn't make it to orbit, but SpaceX is calling it quite a success that it even got off the ground. Where is SpaceX in terms of getting Starship to where it needs to be, and Elon's ultimate goal of colonizing Mars or putting people on Mars?
You know, if you Elon has his own time scale. I mean, he's already talking about they're going to fly again in 2 months. It would be quite something if that happened. But, you know, I was texting with Elon right after Starship blew up. I this is not like propaganda or spin. I mean, you know, with a first rocket, nobody's ever flown a first rocket successfully on the first attempt. To get 4 minutes out of that incredible machine was actually pretty good. I mean, Elon's telling me he thinks they will make it to orbit on the next attempt. And if Starship's successful, you know, it takes the cost of getting stuff to space down so dramatically that all this stuff that I've been writing about and telling you about just increases, you know, by about 1,000-fold in terms of how much stuff we could put in space at a dramatically lower price. And so it would open up a new era. I think everyone's just sitting there waiting to see if this weird looking thing could actually do what's promised. But SpaceX, if anyone's going to do it, it's them. They have an incredible track record.
Yeah, doing this job for 10 years, I've learned to never doubt SpaceX and what Elon says. It will happen, just maybe not when he says it will, right?
Yeah, it's so weird. You know, out of all his companies, you would have thought SpaceX was like the riskiest, least likely to succeed. And somehow it's like the most stable, doing laps around the competition. And give credit to Elon, but I mean, they have thousands of just some of the world's most smartest and most ambitious engineers over there.
We've been speaking with Ashley Vance. His new book is When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was author and journalist Ashley Vance. His new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach, is out now. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. Next week, we'll take a visit to the Daytona Beach Museum of Art and Science, where a new exhibit highlighting the observations of the Webb Space Telescope is set to open. We'll hear about art and science of deep space images. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News with editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.